Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Chisa Kores, the chair of the club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Donna Crawford. Donna Crawford is the Associate Director of Computation at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory since 2001. She has 35 years of computational R&D experience at Lawrence Livermore and Sandia National Laboratories. Donna is responsible for the operation of an integrated high-performance computing facility that ranks among the most capable scientific computing facilities in the world. This computing ecosystem enables achievement of the laboratory mission goals and scientific discovery through simulation. Donna participates in numerous professional organizations, review teams, and panels. She is on the board of directors of Civilian Research and Development Foundation, the advisory board of the Council on Competitiveness High Performance Computing, IBM's Deep Computing Institute's External Advisory Board, and Microsoft's Technical Computing External Advisory Council. Donna received the Computer World Honors Award in 2006 and was named 2005 Woman of the Year in Science in Alameda County. She has a master's degree in operations research from Stanford University, and a bachelor's degree in mathematics from the University of Redlands, California. Please join me in welcoming Donna Crawford.
Thank you, Chisako. And thank you to the audience for coming this evening. For years, I've listened to the Commonwealth Club broadcasts, attended their events, and I've read their magazine. Because as a scientist, the airing of all sides of important issues is critical to me. The airing of all sides of discussion topics. In the world of R&D, it's the friction between competing ideas that often sparks innovation. And for this reason, I'm especially honored to be a Commonwealth Club speaker tonight. So thank you very much for inviting me. I was asked to answer the question, has China surpassed the United States in supercomputing? Since the world revels in sound bites, I'm going to start off with one. If you consider the top 500 list as your metric, then yes, China has surpassed the United States in supercomputing. But since you're here at the Commonwealth Club, I know you value a lot more than a short answer. But for grins, I'm going to give you a different short answer later in my talk. What's, of course, most important is why you care about our discussion topic this evening. To get started, let me provide some context. First part of that context is terminology. I will use the acronym HPC or the phrase high-performance computing interchangeably with the word supercomputing. My talk will focus on supercomputing, even though we know that supercomputing fuels the electronic devices that you have in your pocket that you've just turned off, or those that you have on your wristwatch or will have on your wristwatch in the future. Nonetheless, I'm focusing only on supercomputing tonight. The current world's fastest supercomputers perform calculations in the quadrillions of operations per second. That is petaflops. It's also known as 10 to the 15th. Or a 1 with 15 zeros after it. 10 to the 15th, another way of saying that, is a million billion. You know, I throw these numbers around like they're nothing, yet when I stop and think about them, they're huge, they're daunting. And to imagine 10 to the 15th operations per second is pretty mind-boggling. And yet we've already begun to think about going to the next level of supercomputing, namely exascale, which is 10 to the 18th, or three orders of magnitude improvement over where we are today. So that's the context. So some background. Over the last 10 to 20 years, supercomputers have transformed the way we conduct scientific research. They've enabled discovery and development across a broad spectrum of disciplines, certainly physics, chemistry, bioscience, and engineering. Simulation, the ability to mimic physical phenomena in great detail, is now considered a peer to theory and experiment for scientific discovery. As such, it's a pillar to the scientific method described by Isaac Newton more than 300 years ago. The simulation capabilities that supercomputers allow have advanced medicine, energy, aviation, and even manufacturing, like the packaging of potato chips. The massive complex simulations that run on supercomputers allow us to explore fields like global climate change, as well as tackle problems for which experiments are impractical or hazardous or prohibitively expensive. Let me provide an example from Lawrence Livermore Lab. We use high-performance computing to describe nuclear weapons. These simulations have allowed the National Nuclear Security Administration to ensure the safety, security, and reliability of our nuclear stockpile without underground tests. No new underground tests have been performed since 1992, and no new weapons have been put in stockpile since then, since well before then. As you can imagine, nuclear weapons are extremely complex devices. They're made of thousands of components with myriad materials. Describing that in a simulation is a big task. And yet we've been able to look at how plastics break down and give off potentially destructive gases, how metals can corrode, how coatings can deteriorate. We understand how materials change in the fluctuating environments of high radiation fields, high temperatures, and other environments to which a nuclear weapon is subjected. In the absence of developing nuclear weapons, experts must work to extend the life of these weapons and understand their constituent materials and aging components. Being able to assess the nuclear stockpile without underground tests has allowed, but it has also allowed us to dismantle the nuclear stockpile under treaty agreements at an accelerated pace, and has also given our country the confidence to enter into a new START treaty with the Russians. None of this would have been possible without supercomputing. It was this time-urgent question about the safety and reliability of the stockpile that drove the U.S. Department of Energy and its NNSA, or National Nuclear Security Administration, to invest in the generations of supercomputers that have dominated global HPC for the last 20 years. These computing capabilities developed for national security, of course, have broad application in the general sciences and certainly also in industry. So let me give you another example, this time from industry. Boeing used supercomputers at Oak Ridge National Laboratory to help accelerate the design of its 787 and 747-8. Boeing's Doug Ball summarizes the major benefits of high-performance computing this way. Quote, "It lets engineers design better airplanes with fewer resources in less time. with far less physical simulation based on wind tunnel testing. For example, when we were designing the 767 back in the 1980s, we built and tested about 77 wings. By using supercomputers to simulate the properties of the wings, such on recent models, such as the 787 and the 747-8, we only had to design 7 wings, a tremendous savings in time and cost. End quote. So can you imagine the savings from a 10x improvement in this industrial application? These two examples describe how supercomputers underpin the scientific discovery, technological advancement, and engineering innovation critical to the nation's national security, economic competitiveness, and quality of life. Beyond those two examples, computers make us more productive in many ways. In education, they help broaden our thinking. In hospitals, we have better diagnoses. In business, they're used to keep track of stocks of raw materials and products. In banks, they're used for day-to-day processing of accounts and payments, and on and on and on. These examples are about using the computer to process information. But the technology underpinning the computers is itself important and has fueled many advancements in the internet, in GPS, in the cell phone, safety and security devices in your car, and mass international communication through social media. For years, we've also grappled with using computers for artificial intelligence. In 1990, Ray Kurzweil wrote a book titled The Age of the Intelligent Machines. In it, he portends when computers will begin to think. I'm not going to go into all the ins and outs and ups and downs of artificial intelligence, but I do want to reference the IBM computer Watson, who last week won on Jeopardy. Did you see it? I was really jazzed. The beauty of Watson is its ability to process natural language, make sense of it, and then do what computers do best. Look through lots and lots of data very quickly. So wouldn't you love to have a Watson behind a call center when you're sitting there pushing buttons just trying to get an answer to a simple question? Or when you're doing a web search and you would really like to ask a natural language question rather than the kinds of things we have to put into our web searches today? This is where the technology is going. And this is the context for why computers, and supercomputers in particular, are so important. Even if you don't use a supercomputer, as mentioned earlier, most electronic devices that you use today are the result of supercomputer technology of only 5, 8, or 10 years ago. So computers, and supercomputers in particular, are the foundation of our advancement for almost anything you can think of. And this is why you care about our leadership in high-performance computing. So now let's get back to my response to the question, my short quip that said, using the top 500 metric, yes, China was ahead. Let me explain that metric. Twice a year, we publish the top 500 supercomputers in the world, once in Germany at the International Supercomputer Conference in June, and once in the United States in November at the U.S. Supercomputer Conference. An algorithm for solving a dense system of linear equations, known as the LINPACK benchmark, is used to calculate how quickly a computer can solve a problem, and it returns a single number, nearly the floating point operations of that computer on that solving that set of equations. That single number is what allows us to compare one computer with another. This performance does not reflect the overall performance of a given system. No single number can do that. But it does provide this means of comparing on a common problem. But let me reiterate, the top 500 is not the end-all and the be-all. More about that later. But it is useful because it's widely accepted and widely understood. So, according to that top 500, last November, fresh reports called it a Sputnik moment for the United States. For the first time, the Chinese vaulted to number one and number three positions on that list, displacing HPC systems at Oak Ridge and Los Alamos National Laboratories. The current number one system on the top 500 list is the Chinese Tianhe-1A system. It's at the National Supercomputing Center in Tianjin, and it achieved a performance of 2.57 petaflops. Number two on the list is Jaguar. It's a Cray XT5 system at Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Tennessee. It achieved 1.76 petaflops, which is actually quite a ways behind the number one system, and that's very unusual considering they're usually neck and neck. The number three system on the list is another Chinese system in Shenzhen, and the number four system on the list is Tsubame in Tokyo. The following six systems are in the United States, followed by France, U.S., U.S., Germany, and U.S., respectively. This represents a dramatic change from just a few years ago. Looking at the top 500, of all top 500 systems, 41 of them are Chinese systems. Only 6 months ago, last June, the Chinese had 24 systems. And in fact, over the years, from 1993 until 2001, the Chinese had zero, one, or two systems out of all 500 in any one of those lists. But in 2001, they started a big push for the top. So you can see that this has been a long 10-year haul for them, and it is truly a laudable achievement. So yes, the Chinese has the world's fastest supercomputer and the number three fastest supercomputer on this top 500 list. And as seen earlier, high-performance computing is essential both for national security and for industrial competitiveness in the world economy. China's major investments show they recognize this, and they're willing to make these investments and focus money, energy, and creativity in this direction. While this was a stunning achievement, this does not mean that China has surpassed the U.S. in supercomputing. So to address this question, it's important to look not just at the hardware, but at the low-level software and the applications running on these systems, what I call the computing ecosystem. It includes the physics underlying some particular aspect of reality, the mathematical models that describe that physics, the algorithms that turn those into usable code, and yes, the computer architectures, but also the low-level software such as the compilers and debuggers, performance optimizers, load balancers, networking hardware and software, storage hardware and software, visualization capabilities, all of this which makes the computer usable. The U.S. has been working for six decades, China only one, the U.S. for six decades on this computing ecosystem. We have a balanced and sustained investment across all elements of that ecosystem. And we can now point to discoveries, scientific insights that I previously described, enabled by these supercomputers. So let's take a closer look at that top 500 list. As mentioned, half of the top 10 systems are in the United States. And a number of the foreign systems on the list are based in whole or in part on U.S. components. In fact, the Chinese Tianhe-1A system uses compute node technology from Santa Clara-based NVIDIA. The U.S. has held the number one spot for 24 out of 36 times that this list has been published. Japan has held the number one spot for 11, and China now one. On the most recent list, 274 systems out of 500 are in the United States. and more than 90% of the systems were manufactured by U.S. hardware companies. Of the top five systems that are U.S., they are at Oak Ridge National Laboratory, number 2, Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, number 5, Los Alamos National Laboratory, number 7, number 8, again at Berkeley, and number 10, a partnership between Sandia National Laboratories and Los Alamos. Note, all five of those systems are at Department of Energy National Laboratories. These labs provide much more than just the computer systems. And my data is best, of course, for Livermore, so I'll talk a little bit about Livermore. Livermore is a national security lab, as mentioned earlier, along with Los Alamos and Sandia. Our mission is to do long-term research to help understand and solve pressing national security problems defined broadly. That includes energy security, economic security, environmental security, and certainly, yes, what one normally thinks about national security, stockpile stewardship. Livermore Lab was founded in September of 1952, and by April of 1953, we had our first supercomputer. So it's in our blood, and we've been at it for a long time, as have the other national laboratories. We use computers to study the world around us, to try to understand the intricacies of physical phenomena that happen at really, really short timescales under extreme pressures and temperatures. I'll give you a couple of examples, one more industrial than the other. Recently, Livermore teamed with Navistar, NASA Ames, and the U.S. Air Force to develop and test devices for reducing the aerodynamic drag on semi-trucks. These were simple devices that we designed by using the computer. And the novel part of it was that we considered the tractor and the trailer as a single system. Interestingly enough, the people that make the tractors and the trailers make them separately and don't talk to each other and look at the whole system. We also had to consider the operational aspects. You've got to be able to load that truck up and get out of it, so the devices that you're going to put on there have to take all these things into consideration. By using the computer to design these simple devices, we could increase the fuel efficiency by as much as 12%. If you could deploy that over all of our trucking fleet, that would prevent 36 million tons of carbon dioxide from being released into the atmosphere. Similarly, our expertise in computer simulation is now going to be an integral part of a new national effort in energy efficiency for buildings. When you look at buildings, we generally design them component by component or room by room. We often do that in a static environment. We don't consider people moving in and out. When you consider all those factors together, again, as an integrated system instead of an individual components, and you model the dynamics of that system with the variations of day and night and the variations of seasons, all of a sudden you have a requirement for a supercomputer. For something that you might think is as simple as designing how to make a building more efficient. The other kinds of things that we do is model regional effects of climate change on agriculture and water. We look at structural responses of buildings and bridges to earthquakes. We look into the basic building blocks of matter. We simulate the response of bacteria to antibiotics, et cetera, et cetera. So being number one on the top 500 list is exciting, don't get me wrong, but what really drives us is the problem we're trying to solve. In fact, our goal is not to be number one on the top 500 list. We like it when it happens, but our goal is to solve the problems that we need to solve for our national security mission. So back to stockpile stewardship that I described earlier. When President Bush outlawed underground nuclear tests, the three weapons labs did a back-of-the-envelope calculation that determined we would need 100 teraflops. Now, that's only 10 to the 12th. And this was early in the 1990s. We would need 100 teraflops to do a full physics, full system calculation at a particular resolution, and this calculation should not take more than a whole month running on the entire machine. That's the kind of problem that drives us. It didn't matter that no one at the time had even a single teraflop-capable machine, and the top 500 list was barely in existence. This is the kind of mission driver that sharpens our focus and compels us to make progress, real progress, across the entire ecosystem that I described earlier. So when I talk about being leaders in HPC, I mean we, the United States, own the intellectual property for all aspects of that ecosystem. And today, February 23rd, 2011, the U.S. is the undisputed world leader in HPC hardware, software, and applications. I cite two reports that document that claim. The National Research Council's 2004 Getting Up to Speed, the Future of Supercomputing, and the National Science and Technology Council's 2006 High-End Computing Revitalization Task Force. So, soundbite number two in response to our question earlier. No, China has not surpassed the U.S. in supercomputing. But we have good reason to look over our shoulder, and here's why. While the Chinese TNA-1A system is based on U.S. components, it uses many Chinese-made components, and China's goal is to be able to build supercomputers entirely based on indigenous technology. China has made consistent HPC investments over the last 10 years, as we saw, and they have plans for the next 10 years. In their next five-year plan, they hope to have many petaflop machines and at least one 100 petaflop machine, and they have budgeted $2 billion for this. In their five-year plan after that, from 2016 to 2020, they hope to get from 1 to 10 exaflops using indigenous technology. And they have not released their budget for this. These facts are taken from a published presentation at a conference from Zhubin Shi from the Supercomputing Center, Computer Network Information Center of the Chinese Academy of Sciences. As indicated, their plans are to pursue their own line of processors. In fact, it will be based on the Godson 3 design, commercially called Longsun, and this technology will be in their dawning computer, which should be a petaflop computer, later at the, you know, at the end of this year. So the top 500 list is a demonstration of China's HPC plans and a step along their roadmap. As such, it's a wake-up call to the United States. The U.S. cannot afford to be complacent as the global competition heats up. So there's always been international competition in HPC, but 2011 is different from the past. We're currently experiencing a significant technology disruption. And there's a different climate of global economic competitiveness. These two coupled together with the fact that the U.S. does not have a funded comprehensive plan to address the technology transition provides an opportunity for others to leapfrog us. So briefly, the technology disruption is this. There are four major challenges. The traditional exponential clock rate growth that has given us our 2x performance improvement every 18 to 24 months over the last 15 years, that's ended. Now, instead of increasing the clock frequency, we're doubling the number of chips on a processor. So that's problem number one, which means we have multi-core computer systems that come in a variety of components and packaging, and their challenges is how to use the order million or billions of cores in a single package, let alone get the operating system, the performance tools, and debuggers to work across that much parallelism. Problem three, the additional problem is to that level of parallelism is reliability and resiliency. Something's going to break pretty often. And finally, as we gang more and more of these cores together, the electricity required to power the final system becomes staggering. In fact, it becomes the overarching technology challenge that we have to solve. These challenges are daunting, and they require a sustained, focused R&D effort with the best minds we can find. So we in the DOE, the joint effort between the Office of Science and the NNSA, we have an exascale initiative. It has broad community support. There have been numerous scientific Grand Challenge workshops dedicated to understanding the drivers for exascale. And there's an exascale steering committee with two members from each of the six major labs in HPC. And the DOE is also leading an international exascale software project, recognizing the need to collaborate where possible on some of the daunting challenges. What we don't have is funding at a time when Congress is trying to trim the budget. The relationship of science to economic prosperity and competitiveness is clearly understood. Nonetheless, trends are not encouraging. Over the four decades from 1964 to 2004, our government's support of science declined 60% as a portion of GDP. Meanwhile, other countries aren't holding back. As you saw earlier, China has a 10-year investment plan for supercomputing. China is now the world leader in investing in clean energy technologies. In 2009, they invested $34.6 billion, and we invested $18.6 or 4-ish. China's peer-reviewed science and technology publication rate in the open literature surpassed that of the U.S. in 2007. There's also trouble on the education front. In January, the Washington Post reported U.S. undergraduate institutions, they award 16% of their degrees in the natural sciences and engineering. In China, they award 47%. America ranks 27th among developed nations in the proportion of students receiving undergraduate degrees in science and engineering. On a per-student basis, state support for public universities has declined for more than two decades and what is at its lowest level in a quarter century before the economic downturn. So I earlier referred to America's Sputnik moment. That happened in 1957. And that moment galvanized support for science and technology and the education needed to make that science and technology happen. In 1958, Congress established NASA, which led not only to men on the moon, but also to huge breakthroughs in computers, building materials, and many other technologies. That same year, lawmakers passed the National Defense Education Act, which increased federal investment in education nearly sixfold. Here I have to quote David Gergen, senior political analyst at CNN, in his Commonwealth Club speech last July. Quote, "A sage once said that America is excellent when we have a wolf at the door. We are pretty terrible when we have termites in the basement," end quote. Supercomputing may lack the glamour of the space race, but failing to meet the challenge before us has consequences that reach further and more broadly into our economic future. Supercomputers have become a differentiating tool for discovery and innovation with profound impacts on science, national security, and industrial competitiveness. In its 2008 report, The New Secret Weapon, the U.S. Council on Competitiveness said, quote, "Supercomputing is part of the corporate arsenal to beat rivals by staying one step ahead on the innovation curve. It provides the power to design products and analyze data in ways once unimaginable," end quote. The bottom line, according to the council, is to outcompete, you need to outcompute. So as we look to the future, computing's at a crossroad. Merely refining and scaling up the current technology won't get us to exascale computers. We've reached the design limits of our current technology and need a sustained R&D effort. We need to reduce 5 to 10-fold the electricity required to power supercomputers. Without this, an exascale computer would need order 100 megawatts just to power the computer. That's enough to power a small city, and it comes with a price tag of about $100 million a year to pay the power bill. There aren't too many places that will be able to house one of those and afford one of those. So we have to solve that problem. In addition, computers will need to be self-aware. They are going to have to overcome the failures inevitable in machines with millions and billions of components performing quintillions of simultaneous tasks. So needless to say, the development and then later the integration of these technologies into consumer products will have a tremendous economic opportunity for the nation that brings these technologies to market. So for some people, the numbers associated with supercomputing are mind-boggling. Trillions and quadrillions of operations moving to quintillions. It's not unreasonable to ask just how much computing processing power is really needed. I don't think I know the answer to that. It's beyond my comprehension to think of being able to represent in a computer the physical intricacies of, say, the entire universe. We can't even do it for our entire globe. And we know that that's a long way off. And so we will always have challenges. We will always have the next horizon to accomplish in our supercomputing technology. There are many problems close at hand already pushing the limits of what we can do with a supercomputer. Take, for example, global climate change. We are still actually very rudimentary in what we can do in spite of all we have learned from our simulations for global climate change. We can look at what's going on in the atmosphere or in the ocean or sea ice or land surface temperatures, but coupling all those systems together with all the detailed physics that one needs, we can't do that in the supercomputers that we have today. Like climate modeling, each scientific domain has problems awaiting the arrival of the exascale system and beyond. So to summarize, we're entering this new supercomputing era as the global leader in HPC, but our leadership is being threatened. Unlike the past, U.S. leadership faces an unprecedented challenge, principally from China, but also from other global players. China is steadily increasing its investment and marshaling the technological capabilities to quickly develop next-generation supercomputers. They clearly understand the value of this investment. We in the U.S., on the other hand, are working to formulate an investment strategy in the face of budget-cutting political pressures. We need to understand we're in a global competition with determined rivals. Competition is generally a good thing. It makes everyone better and sparks innovation. But we need to make a commitment to compete with equal resources and equal determination. My own personal belief has to do with equality. When I'm competing, I want to compete with someone who's just about my equal. It's no fun to play with somebody who's a lot better than me, and it's no fun to play with somebody who's well behind me. Not only is it not fun, I don't improve. So it's not that I want to beat China per se, it's that I want to have parity with them. I don't want to rely on them for the chip technology embedded in the supercomputers we use for national security. I don't want to rely on them for the low-level software to run my supercomputer because they figured out the parallelism before we did. I don't want to rely on them, or anyone else for that matter, for my standard of living, for my safety and security, for the innovation that propels us forward, for the open dialogue and communications devices, all of which rely on supercomputing. I want the U.S., I want us, to be self-reliant, capable, and responsible for our own prosperity. If we are to be partners in a world of global competition, I want us to come from a position of strength, based on the best U.S. industry, academia, and the national labs has to offer. That's what put us and has kept us in the leadership role we enjoy today in supercomputing. It's imperative we now begin to push forward on the necessary technology to ensure a continued leadership position. The stakes are very high. Thank you.
the listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Has China Surpassed the U.S. in Supercomputing? With Donna Crawford. Our thanks to Donna for her comments here today. Now we open the floor to a Q&A session. I will be passing around this microphone unless you'd like to come up and speak into the microphone. Would you like me to pass around or would you like to come up front? Okay, vote. Okay, so who's pass around? Okay, I'll pass around. Okay, so I'll be passing around the microphone, and if you have questions, please wait until you have the microphone since we are recording this program. Any questions?
Thank you very much, Donna. It was fascinating to hear you talk about competition between us and China. I was surprised that they rely mostly on our NVIDIA chips. I would have thought it would be some Intel chip, the biggest chip makers in the world. So I don't know why it is that they rely on NVIDIA rather than Intel. So that's the one question. But the same way that you say you don't like to rely on them to make a chip for us that would do the work of national security, what is their worry about us making the NVIDIA chips for them where they are using it to back up their national security system? How would, are they in the same mentality as we are?
I think it clearly shows from their roadmap and their plans to build their computers based on indigenous technology that they have the same fears. And that's to be expected. They should have their strongest technology that they possibly can for their economy, for their national security, for their scientific discovery. I can't answer the question why they chose NVIDIA. They have other systems based on other chip technologies. But Intel is one of the primary chip makers you find in many, many computer systems. As I said earlier, 90% of the computers on that top 500 list are manufactured by U.S. hardware manufacturers with chip technology coming from the United States. In fact, China is the only one I know of so far that has the plans to actually build their own chips for their own supercomputers. So I believe they have the same concerns that we do, and they're working to rectify that.
Okay, another question?
My question has to do with the relationship between free markets technology and a legislative system. I have a tendency toward nightmares, and often based on conversations, and this one is based on a conversation with an unidentified meteorologist I met in Australia. My nightmare says that we can cause eco-terrorism by manipulating through supercomputers the stratosphere, ionosphere, the atmosphere, because we already know we can change the routes of monarch butterflies by tampering with the weather, and also biologic warfare. And we could all do this in the name of science, and we would be these would be forms of warfare which our president would not have to go to Congress for to have legislated. Do you have any of these nightmarish fears?
I think that's a long debate. Certainly, technologies can always be used for multiple purposes. And coming from a national security laboratory, when my family questioned, why are you going to work there? They design nuclear weapons. My response was that I would rather have that in my hands, the hands of a civilian who wants to use it for deterrent, but not to actually really use it. I would rather have it in my hands than somebody else's hands. Perhaps not the answer you want. So any technologies can be used for good or for evil. I think as a scientist, we can't put the genie back in the bottle. We have to try to find the good in what we are discovering. The discoveries propel new discoveries. and we have to always try to protect ourselves and our planet in the best ways possible. And supercomputing is certainly one of the ways that we can understand what's happening in our environment and then try to prevent it or to mitigate it if we can't prevent it.
Dr. Crawford, I had the dubious honor of attending a congressional hearing yesterday talking about transportation finance. And everything that was discussed there had to go back to figuring out a way to make money on the systems being considered or on the technology being reviewed. And I guess that's a function of our tax aversion now in the United States, which is very sad. Is there a way for your vast computing capacity and that held by other computers around the United States to increase the profitability in a manner that would increase revenue sources that might then be reinvested in expanding your computing capacity?
That's an interesting thought. We generally invest the government funds in long-term research that no one particular industry is willing to invest in. So the supercomputing technology that is in your electronic devices today and that people are making money off of today, that was invested in 15 years ago, fielded 10 years ago, and then trickled down. And so how do I capture the revenues from those sources today to fuel that research and development? I mean, the kinds of computing that I'm talking about is pushing that bleeding edge. And there are very few people that want to put the R&D into that long-term investment. And as I've said, we've had this long-term investment for decades, but not just in the chip technology or in the low-level software, but it also in the physics models, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Which one industry would be willing to fuel that investment? And that's the difficult conversation that one gets in. We certainly can point to, and the Boeing example I gave is a good one. When you can reduce the number of wing designs that you have to do from 77 to 7, that's a huge time and cost savings. So I can't even put a price tag on it, but maybe you can, Jale. Billions, okay, thank you. But how do we reap that back into pushing that technology so that they have it available to them tomorrow? And I would love for you to help me with that answer because I'm in the same boat you are in trying to justify why we need the investment. In this technology disruption that's occurring right now means we can't do the things we've been doing. We need an investment strategy, which will take 8-10 years before we have the new platforms that are riding a new curve. I need to make those same justifications for why that's important. I can point to the past, but in our current climate, it's a very difficult argument, as you well know. So maybe we can kibitz over the answer to that later.
Given the restrictions on the export of advanced direct military technology and hardware, do you believe, do any of these restrictions apply to dual-use hardware such as computational hardware and know-how? And if not, do you believe some of those restrictions should apply? And also, then the follow-up question on intellectual property respect. There is much written about export of technology and then potential sort of assimilation of it in China. Do some of those concerns apply, again, to this dual-use technology? Thank you.
I think there are a lot of smart people in the world, and you can take these components, which are not necessarily controlled in the form of export, and develop wonderful things. And actually, we have seen that over the years. In spite of or because of export control laws, people have found a way around them. So it might be better to try to be more open and to work collaboratively where it makes sense, on pre-competitive ideas, like we are doing on the software now in the International Exascale Software Project. We know, we don't know the answer, but we know we're going to have to solve this parallelism problem, you know, billions away parallelism. We've had this nice model of message passing for the last 10 years, 15 years, and we're going to have to do something new. We don't know the answer, so we can start working on that now, and we are working internationally with many, many people. And then the way you use the technology for your particular application is perhaps where you keep your intellectual property. Now, no one's asking me that, so that's a personal answer, and I don't know what the Department of Commerce would have to say about that.
Dr. Crawford, thank you for a very clear presentation. As you know, the New START Treaty passed in December after considerable wrangling in the Congress and considerable negotiation over the budget for stockpile stewardship and other testing and improvements to our existing nuclear weapons. And I think as the result of the debate in December, about another $5 or $6 billion was added to the nuclear weapons program budget, making it about $85-86 billion over the next 10 years. My hope is that some of those excess funds might be benefiting your programs. And so can you say a little bit about the current funding of maintenance and improvement programs for our nuclear weapon systems and whether those benefit the agenda of R&D in supercomputing?
That's a very good question. Right now, in our current budget, there is no funding, as I mentioned, for an exascale project or for the research and development on a long, sustained path forward. The first things that we see in the budget as a result of this plus-up to build out everything around the nuclear weapons complex in order to be able to assure that we can go forward with the New START Treaty are for two major facilities, one at Savannah River and one at Los Alamos. I think over time we might be able to make an argument that this is an enabling technology that will allow us to move forward and that we will hopefully be able to have some of those budget funneled in this direction. I mean, when we started the stockpile stewardship program, there were a couple of major components, some very large facilities so we could do above-ground experiments at particular scales, and the computing infrastructure to be able to use that as the integration of all the past underground test data and then the new above-ground test data. And as we go forward to be able to understand what's happening as we dismantle weapons, have fewer kinds in the stockpile, and they're getting older and older and getting further and further away from underground test data, then we need additional facilities and additional computing capabilities. And so hopefully those will be part of the arguments that we put forward to justify the budget expenditures. And if we are successful in that and can tap into some of that $85 billion over the next 10 years, then we might, in fact, be able to push the edge and have some of the other effects that we have mentioned.
Hi, Doctor. I have two very simple questions. First, should this exascale, is that how you call it? Is that how you pronounce it?
That's good, Mike.
Okay. If and when that benchmark is met, you said that this device would require 100 megawatts, much like a small city, right? Is that correct?
If we took, and not even, if we took current technology
right.
and simply scaled it up, you'd actually get to a gigawatt. But we know that there's some smart things that we can do, so we're pretty sure we can get an exascale computer system at 100 megawatts.
Okay, well, my question is, what is that housing? In what space is something like that house? How much room is required for it? How big is it?
Let's see. Right now, I have a 20 petaflop computer coming into the lab. It will require 6 megawatts of power, and it will take up 8,000 square feet. So multiply that by 10 if you were to do a simple scale up.
How many cubic feet?
I don't know, 8,000 square feet divide by uh-huh.
No. Okay, all right, good. The other question I had was are the Russians or the Soviet legacy scientific establishment, are they still in the game?
Absolutely. The Russians have a top 50 list, and even when they were not investing in hardware the way we were, they had extremely good software. And now they've actually started investing in hardware as well. So there are many other global players, and I didn't address what's happening in Europe and what's happening in Japan and Russia.
You've talked about the ecosystem of computing. You've talked about how we got there in the Department of Energy, going with a teraflop to 100 teraflop to solve specific problems. I'd like to see you comment on two other points. One is now there are multiple lists going, the top 500, but there's all the graphics 500, and there's data lists. And so those are almost, they don't get the glory, but they're out there as important. But the other thing, too, is that we used to design a machine and then fit our problems to that machine. We're now seeing this trend of actually can we customize, and I should say it's been around a while, but we're now seeing the next generation of customization of machine toward problems. And there's a lot more focus from the very start. That you go to solve problems. Can you comment about how you think that would fit in to the national program going forward, rather than just hitting exascale, and why we should look at also what the diversity of the systems we should be building is?
So the first comment is on that top 500 metric, and I didn't go into all the other metrics, but I did mention that the top 500 is not the end-all and the be-all, because there's so many more things that are important, including the ecosystem, and not just how well you perform on the LIMPAC benchmark. And in addition, it's like how much power do you use? How well can you process certain kinds of information, different sets of benchmarks? So all those things, of course, are important. And in the end, what really matters is can you solve the problem that you need to solve for your business or your mission or your goals? And that leads me to your next question, which is, well, why not just design a computer that is special purpose for your problem? And there are certainly the GRAPE computer system in Japan is one such, and it's lightning fast, and it was not tremendously expensive, but now it will only do that one particular problem. In the national laboratories, we are looking at describing physical phenomena across a large spectrum. And so it's very difficult for us to buy one machine that would solve this kind of problem and a different machine that would solve that kind of problem and so on. And so by the time you add them all together, you end up costing more than finding the solution to a general purpose machine. And so that's been our approach to this for many years. The other comment I think you made was about competition, which was how many different approaches should we take now as we're trying to move from this petascale era to the exascale era. And we certainly have to do more than one. We may only be able to afford two, but then we have our rivals elsewhere doing three or four. And so between all of those together, hopefully we'll find a system that works for most of us.
Hi. Can you please comment on the current status of the scientific exchange of communication with China? Is this a two-way street on the HPC area?
We are beginning dialogue, and there's certainly many, many collaborations. I think I'm probably more familiar with the collaborations on clean energy technologies, because, as I mentioned earlier, our laboratory works also on energy security, energy technologies, and we have many partnerships with China in that arena. I'm going to visit the two supercomputing centers in China in June with the hopes of establishing some collaborations. They are very open about what they're doing, about their plans. That's why I quoted a particular talk. They give talks at the major international supercomputing conferences around the world every year. And I think they're eager, again, to collaborate where it makes sense for them and to compete where it makes sense for them. So, you know, this is relatively new for them, and therefore it's relatively new for us as well, and we're all trying to feel our way and to figure out what's going to make sense. So we'll see how that plays out over the next decade.
Besides the U.S. and China, what other countries are on your radar screen in terms of supercomputing capacity, both, you know, pure capacity, but also in relation to your ecosystem terms? Who are high on the list besides the U.S. and China?
The European Union has a very strong partnership across all of their countries, but primarily France and Germany, working one of the top 10 systems is in Germany at the Forschungszentrum Jülich, and we work very closely with them. CEA, the equivalent of our Atomic Energy Association in France, has a very large supercomputing system, and we also are partnering with them on that as well. So the European Union is also looking at pushing the boundaries, and we go to their conferences and they come to ours, and actually there we have active collaborations.
Okay, we have time for only one last question, so I guess you haven't asked any questions before, right? So, oh, you did. Okay, so
I'll ask you later. This is a totally non-technical question, more political. As we see a change in how people feel about science and the importance and the skepticism of science, you go to Washington a lot. Are you seeing a change in the political climate there? That, and our budget crisis aside, do you see it increasingly difficult to obtain funding for important scientific research in the future?
I think people understand the value of science. They talk about the value of science, but they're really not willing. Now, who's they? But, you know, the funding is becoming more and more difficult, especially right now when we're looking at where we are after the economic downturn and how we're trying to write the budget according to some. Where do we want to make investments? Where do we want to make cuts? And it's a very heated debate on all sides. And so, yes, it is more difficult. You get lots of verbal support for what you're doing and why you're doing it. But then when it comes to funding it, it's more and more difficult. So that's the climate right now.
Thank you, Donna. Okay. So thanks to Donna for her comments here today. We also thank the audience here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 108th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.